Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 26th, 2024. My name is Sam Cedar, but this, what am I doing here? This is an Emma Majority shit day.
It's Emma-jority. Get it right.
I don't have to say it.
You're here, and that's because we're beaming in from the past. Recording this whenever we're recording this. People don't need to know.
Nope.
On the program today, two interviews from Emma-jority Report Thursdays. Neil J. Young, author of Coming Out Republican, A History of the Gay Right. And later in the show, Adrienne Marie Brown, author of Loving Corrections. The first interview was from August with Neil, and the interview with Adrian was from September. And I think a lot of people in the audience responded well to these. The interview with Neil and the history of the gay right, gay Republicans, the log cabin Republicans, it really is fascinating. And it's an example of... It's very relevant today with Peter Thiel and his funding of the Republican Party, and like how far back this closeted religious conservative fundamentalist movement within the Republican Party goes. And it was just a really thoughtful conversation as well. It wasn't just one that was focused on demonizing anyone in particular. And then Adrienne Marie Brown, who is a great writer. She stylizes her name in the bell hooks fashion, writer, activist, author of a book called Loving Corrections. And it's really about building solidarity through empathy right now in the progressive movement. And so I thought these were two interviews that were relevant for the holiday season. Interesting. Our audience had kind of flagged them at the time that they would be good best ofs. And so here you go. Hope you enjoy them.
They sound great. I mean, I'm fascinated because the log cabin Republicans were really sort of prominent in the aughts, and mm-hmm. they were sort of like very conflicted when, you know, George W. Bush was out there using gay marriage as a way of driving his right-wing vote out in.
But he goes back to the Lavender Scare to talk essentially about how there were a lot of gay Republicans who participated in that as a way to overcompensate. He also goes back to like the origins of the religious right in California, and specifically that reactionary conservative movement. And then, you know, Reagan became president later, but that tried to really go after queer people in particular. And so, like, you just see, and then, of course, the AIDS epidemic comes right after that. So it was just like a really, you know, interesting history of the somewhat recent past, really the back half of the 20th century, and how gay Republicans even became a thing.
I think there was a guy, I think his name was David Dreyer, but I'm not sure. I think so. And he, I think it was him. He was a Republican whip, I think, during the aughts. And his other Republicans, the Republicans, they knew he was gay. He was sort of closeted, at least publicly. But they wouldn't even, some of them wouldn't even shake his hand.
Right.
Weird stuff like that.
Right.
And I remember at that 2004 Republican convention, was on the floor of the convention with a sign looking for a gay Republican or a log cabin Republican. I had both on both sides of the sign. Almost got thrown out by the Secret Service.
I've seen that clip.
It was only because of a pin.
Right.
Folks, there's your lesson. If you're going to... do anything like that, where Secret Service is at, try and get a flag lapel pin from a different Secret Service guy.
There you go. There's your tip.
There's your tip of the day. And I hope everybody had a good Christmas. What'd you get for presents?
Oh, I don't know. Hopefully some gift cards. But no one wants to give those because people want the, and I'm included in this, the ego trip of giving a physical gift.
Is then there you an can ego trip?
I think so. Like I don't know. But
it just seems more personal to give a
more a personal, gift. Right? But at this point, like you know, I want new furniture. That's really I'm on a mission, and I'm hoping I can rack up these gift cards. I'm asking when people ask what I want for Christmas, I'm telling them every time what I want.
I got a couple of good use sites for furniture. You're looking at me like with
no, not well. Yes, I'll go there once I know how much money I'm working with in the gift card market. I have a few different things that I want. I want a new rug. I want a new TV stand. I want a new dresser. So I'm in the market for I'll be looking at used stuff too. But
I hope you got it.
We'll see. That's my goal.
I hope you got it. And last night after Hanukkah, you know what I got from my kids? Nothing.
No. All right.
What are you going to do?
They'll get you something.
Folks, stick around for these two approved interviews.
Yes.
Then Matt may have a clip or two after this. We'll see. I'm not sure how long it'll be. Tomorrow, we're going to have another best of. We're going to take this all the way to 2025. But stick around for Adrian Marie Brown. But first, Neil J. Young.
We are back, and we are joined now by Neil J. Young, writer and author of Coming Out Republican, A History of the Gay Right. Neil, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, the Gay Republican, how do you start your history of the Gay Republican? Where is the first kind of marker that you'd like to throw down in terms of the conservative movement and gay people or LGBTQ plus people within that movement?
Yeah, I mean, when I set out to write the book, I thought that it would start in the late 1970s because that's when the first gay Republican organizations were formed. But as I dug into the research, I realized I actually wanted to begin in the 1950s, in the era of the Cold War, and this period that was known as the Lavender Scare, where the federal government was, you know, repressing homosexuals all over the country, was criminalizing their behavior, arresting them. But I realized there was a lot of prominent, very closeted, but important gay Republican activists, both in Washington, D.C., who were, you know, fundamental to the rise of modern conservatism, and also folks who were out in California, where a lot of my book is set, who were starting to be politically active, but were doing so, again, as closeted or semi-closeted gay Republicans.
The Lavender Scare, can you expand on that? And what were the origins of that moral panic, basically?
Yeah. So in the 1950s, at the height of the Cold War, there were, you know, huge fears that the country was under communist threat and that subversives within the nation would betray the country to the communists. And so there was, you know, the Red Scare, which was about rooting out communists from the U.S. and especially in the federal government, this idea that they were in the State Department, that they were turning over state secrets to the communists, to the Soviet Union. But there was also this idea that homosexuals were a subversive threat to the nation, because the idea was that homosexuals were very likely to be turned. This notion was that they were sexual deviants, and so they could also become political deviants. They would be easily turned into communists, and that they would serve as spies within the federal government, especially the State Department. And so both political parties were very committed to rooting out homosexuals from any service in the federal government. But that spirit and even that sort of political effort bled out to all over the country. So local law enforcement in every city was, you know, interested in finding homosexuals, arresting them, criminalizing them, and really ruining their lives. And this was a, you know, a horrific and really invasive work on the part of the government to criminalize and ruin homosexuals' lives in the mid 20th century.
How were laws deployed in that way? I mean, were there a lot, you know, we see in the context particularly of abortion right now, like the reuse, the re-upping of anti, you know, of pro-censorship or laws that are supposed to regulate basically people from being deviant in any way. What were some of those tactics that law enforcement used?
Yeah, so this started at, you know, at the top. President Eisenhower issued an executive order in 1950 that, you know, that oversaw the government's work in rooting out homosexuals from government employment. But, you know, at the state and local level, there are all sorts of like vice laws that had to do with things like gross indecency or public indecency. And these gave law enforcement and police huge leeway to arrest people that they suspect of being homosexual. I mean, they didn't even have to necessarily catch someone in the act. But often they saw, you know, groups of men walking down the street, or if you were sitting in a park, you could be arrested on charges of gross indecency. And so those are just sort of some examples. But I also think it's, you know, really important to know that every department, every agency of the government was really devoted to this. This included the U.S. Post Office. The Post Office was in coordination with the FBI, was surveilling people that they suspected of being homosexual, watching their mail, tracing it. If you subscribe to a physique magazine, or if they noticed that you were writing a lot, if you were a single man and you were writing a lot of letters to other single men, they would put trackers on those other men's mail. And so, and if they suspected of being homosexual from the mail they were writing or the mail they were receiving, they would turn their names over to law enforcement and have them arrested. And so I think people don't appreciate or really know this history of how extensive law enforcement and the federal government's network was in finding homosexuals and arresting them, criminalizing them, and again, ruining their lives.
And I have so many questions. One is, I noticed the focus on men, right?
Yes.
Moral panic being fairly directed towards homosexual men. But also when you mentioned the FBI and its role in having the post office track individuals in this manner, I mean, J. Edgar Hoover, if you could just talk about him and his sexuality and how that played into his obsessiveness on topics of this matter.
Yeah, I mean, so he's very important here. Obviously directing a lot of this work, and you know, historians have weighed in, including Beverly Gage's recent biography of him, that, you know, says that he very much was involved in a long-term relationship with a male that was very close to him and that worked with him. And I think that there's a lot of sort of figures in this period who we view, I think rightly so, as hypocrites because of the way in which they were living their lives one way, but directing the government to repress homosexuals' lives. And so I think that just sort of speaks to the nature of the fear that was at work in this period and how overwhelming the sort of spirit of the Lavender Scare was. But it is important to know that and to recognize that there were homosexual men who facilitated that Lavender Scare. And I think a lot of them, such as Hoover, did so to direct attention away from them.
Right. And the focus on men, you know, I think about... Yeah. Often, like, we're in the midst of an anti-trans moral panic, and so much of it is about trans women, right?
Right.
The idea that somebody who was born with male genitalia is actually a woman is so threatening to this cultural conception of masculinity. Yeah. And I think that pairs nicely, I mean, not nicely, but in the way that the moral panic or the Lavender Scare and the crackdown that resulted is focused on men and homosexual behavior there as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart connection. And I would say that, you know, in a patriarchal society, which the U.S. is, and particularly so in the mid-20th century, fears about manhood and masculinity really shape a lot of governmental action. And I think also just like cultural responses to changing, you know, gender expressions and changing sexual norms. And so, you know, lesbians certainly had difficult experiences during the Lavender Scare, and they were also targeted as well, but not at all to the extent that gay men were. And part of that was that gay men tended to have a lot more public lives. Like, they tended to be a lot more sort of out in the open to the extent that closeted persons were at all. And so that's part of it. But I think at the deeper level, it is this sort of panic around manhood and masculinity. And again, what that meant in the Cold War context, right? We're right. in this arms race with another nation. We're worried about the future of our society and our nation and our strength at home, because that sort of registers on the world stage. And I think that's how these things sort of got tied together.
I mean, it occurs to me, and I want to move past the 1950s in a second, but that this is really, honestly, the birth of the modern conservative movement that we see to this day, of the linking of anti-communism, which ends up being free market fundamentalism for them, with a social conservatism that was about cracking down on gay people, lifestyles that they deem outside of the mainstream, and also, of course, married with their anti-civil rights agenda. I mean, you can see that is the Republican Party, really, to this day.
Absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right here to point to this moment in which those different components of the right, which aren't necessarily affiliated with the Republican Party in the 1950s, are starting to get stitched together into what we would call the new right in the 1970s, which is this broad coalition of different sorts of conservatives who are linked together in a national movement. A lot of this work is happening at the grassroots level, right? Connecting cultural conservatives to anti-communists, to, you know, free market radicals, and stitching it together into what we really recognize as a coordinated Republican Party, especially around like the 1980 election and the rise of Ronald Reagan. But absolutely, it's getting forged in the 1950s and the height of the Cold War. It's sort of amping up through the 1960s and the cultural transformations of that era, and really, I think, coalescing in a 1970s movement of grassroots conservatives that has like a religious right that's ascendant.
Yes. And so let's go to the 1970s, right? Where, you know, the backlash against the revolutions, the civil rights advancements of the 1960s, as well as, you know, massive cultural changes of with feminism and progress in those areas. You see the 1970s as an era of backlash, right? And the expansion really of the government's role in basically like being tough on crime, the federal government's role, whether it be the origins of the drug war as a way to have that backlash formalized against often, mm-hmm. you know, black and brown people in this country, but as well as it relates to gay people and using the federal government to crack down on gay folks. What was the role of the gay Republican during that era?
Yeah, because this is a period in which part of what's happening is the development of anti-LGBTQ, but at the time it would have been known as an anti-gay politics. This taking shape in the mid-1970s. You think about 1969 Stonewall. Is this turning point in gay history where so many people start coming out of the closet. And also in the early 1970s, a lot of cities and local municipalities start passing these non-discrimination laws that are tied to homosexuality, towards gay identity. And so that's sort of happening in the early 70s. In the mid-1970s, you have this religious right movement that's just starting to form. They're starting to get, you know, united around an anti-abortion cause, but they're also recognizing that sort of gay rights are moving forward. And so there's this backlash effort of anti-LGBTQ stuff that's happening in the late 1970s. This is the moment in which gay Republicans really come out of the closet and start organizing. And there's a particular reason they do so, which is here in California, where I live. In 1977, there's a state ballot initiative that's put forward by a very conservative state legislator from Orange County named John Briggs. And it was Proposition 6, or as it was mm-hmm. commonly known, the Briggs Initiative, which was on the 1978 California state ballot. And had it passed, it would have made it a illegal for any gay or lesbian person to work in the state's public school system. And so this is the moment in which gay Republicans recognize they have to come out of the closet. They have to start organizing as gay Republicans to defeat this ballot initiative, but also to show the Republican Party, especially in the state of California, hey, we belong to your party. We're Republicans. We believe in, you know, the Republican Party's traditional message of freedom, opportunity, and equality. And we're not only going to defeat this ballot initiative, we're going to push out these, who are these Bible beaters that are trying to come into our party? Who is this religious right that thinks that they're Republicans? We're going to push them out of the party and make sure they never get a foothold. And so that's the moment in which this is happening, really, in California. But they are developing a movement that ultimately spreads across the nation. As these gay Republicans say, we belong to this party. We're not going to see it change in the direction that it seems to be going.
They were not successful.
They were not.
It's almost as like as if that, you know, you can't make progress in that regard in this party that targets marginalized people broadly. But it's fascinating, that the California element to me.
Yeah.
You know, Harvey Milk, of course, in the 1970s becomes the first openly gay elected official in the country and is assassinated. You know, talk about the role of the San Francisco politics of that time period as well in fostering that backlash within California Republicans.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about Harvey Milk, because one of the most surprising and just wonderful things I discovered as I was in the archives, actually in San Francisco, looking at the papers of the first gay Republican club that was started, which at the time was called Concerned Republicans for Individual Rights. It's now known as Log Cabin Republicans of San Francisco. It's been around since 1977. Harvey Milk was involved with the founding of this organization. He was at the first meeting of this organization, because Harvey Milk, although he was a Democrat, he believed that gay people had to, first of all, come out of the closet, and they had to show both political parties that they belong to them. This idea was, none of us are being well represented. And honestly, the Democratic Party wasn't all that much better on gay rights or accepting gay members in the 1970s than the Republicans were. And so there was this notion that this sort of bipartisan organizational effort needed to happen. We'll belong to both. We already belong to both parties, right? We will show ourselves to be visible within both parties. And through that, we will make gay rights, we'll progress gay rights, and we'll show that gay rights are a bipartisan issue, or ideally nonpartisan issue. In San Francisco, it was also really interesting to discover that the local leadership of the Republican Party was incredibly supportive of the formation of these gay Republican clubs, because Republicans were basically so underrepresented in the city. Not many people in San Francisco were registered as Republicans. Republicans didn't have any political offices. And so the Republican leadership there thought, well, maybe the path forward is us tapping into this very large population of homosexuals who live in this city, getting them to register with the Republican Party, and hopefully electing local officials. And so San Francisco is this sort of unique spot in California in many ways, but particularly in the ways that it actually is the birthplace of gay Republicanism, which I think most people wouldn't think of. The Republican Party at the state level in California, and certainly in Southern California, that was much more conservative, was not nearly as welcoming or as encouraging as of this development of gay Republicans. But San Francisco, because of the nature of its politics, and because of the fact that Republicans were so underrepresented, it really became, for many years, the sort of central, you know, the nexus of gay Republicanism, and certainly formed the sort of foundation upon which the larger movement was built.
And you could probably put a pin there and say this is the original infrastructure for passing Proposition 8. I mean, right? In 2008, was that when Prop 8 passed? I know we're skipping ahead.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think that the yes, and I also think the important thing to point to is California again. Like, California is this place of progress and also this place where we see conservative backlash happening again and again around LGBTQ issues. And, you know, there's this old saying that's used a lot in American politics, which is, as California goes, so goes the nation. This idea that this state, the largest state in the country, is sort of leading indicator of what's going to happen in the country politically. And I think that's right. But I also think that this sort of narrative of progress and backlash that you see over and over again in California is represents the sort of larger development within the country of progress and backlash when it comes to LGBTQ rights. So California, you know, is one of those leading states when it comes to the passage of same-sex marriage. And also it's a place that sort of immediately generates an enormous backlash that becomes a really defining one for the country as, you know, Prop 8 is passed and this huge progressive measure is overturned. And that's seen as like decimating to the, you know, development of same-sex marriage rights for the entire country, as it is for, you know, a short period of time.
Who's governor of California during this time period? One Ronald Reagan. I guess that we could talk about Reaganism, how that relates to gay Republicans and gay rights in this period. And also, I guess, if you could expand a little bit more on who the log cabin Republicans were as they become a faction within the GOP.
Yeah. So in the late 1970s, the folks who are forming these gay Republican clubs, which are, you know, most of them have sort of log cabin in their name. And of course, that's a reference to Abraham Lincoln, who they believe they are in the sort of true tradition of. They tend to, I mean, it's like 99% of these clubs are white gay men. They're almost all entrepreneurs or small business owners or professional types, lawyers, businessmen. In a lot of ways, they look like the average Republican man, other than their sexual identity. But they tend to have a very sort of conservative fiscal policy, even as they want the Republican Party and the government to change around sort of issues of gay rights. But they really argue that they're libertarians, right? And they have this idea of like, the government should stay out of my bedroom and out of my wallet. And that a smaller government, a restrained government that has less power, is the pathway to freedom. So that's the message that they're developing in the late 1970s. And certainly that's what they believe the Republican Party stands for. But as you note, I mean, this guy, Ronald Reagan, who had sort of governed as one way as California governor, he's going to be very different once he becomes president of the U.S. in the 1980s, particularly because why does he win his election? In large part because social conservatives, the religious right, bands behind him and makes him president. And so he acts very differently in the 1980s. And also we have the rise of HIV/AIDS happening. So that's changing all the politics here. And in a lot of ways, I think it's catching these gay Republicans by surprise and turning their party into something that, you know, they certainly don't stand for and they really don't recognize.
There's so much here. I mean, there's the identity of gay Republicans in the sense that, like, does white man come first?
Right.
Right. And then, of course, there's the Reaganism element and the reactionary backlash to HIV/AIDS and his essentially allowance of HIV/AIDS to spread because basically it's God's will telling gay people that you're wrong. And so it's a pandemic for gay people to punish them, I guess. I mean, like, that was basically the way that. Reagan approached it. And then also, I mean, you have Ed Koch in New York City, too, right, who was a gay man himself,
right.
And how he bought into this as well. I mean, I'm this is barely a question, but if you could just talk about that period.
Well, it's an incredibly important era of American history and particularly of the modern GOP because, you know, and there's folks like Gary Bauer and Pat Buchanan who are high ranking Reagan White House officials who are like hardline conservatives. And they are really pushing the sort of ugly anti-gay politics that we see emerging, particularly in the late 1980s around HIV/AIDS. And one of the things that I found really fascinating was if you look at public polling around homosexuality in the early 80s, it's a lot higher in terms of levels of acceptance than I think we would have imagined for that period. But what happens is the, you know, HIV/AIDS crisis becomes sort of so overwhelming, and social conservatives really use it to ramp up a new wave of homophobia within the Republican Party, but across the nation more broadly. And those, you know, public attitudes about homosexuality, they plummet in the second half of the 1980s. And I think importantly for the sort of trajectory of the Republican Party, you see the reemergence and the reinvigoration of social conservatism in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that becomes really ugly, becomes really anti-gay and really vicious. And of course, that affects the anti-abortion efforts and all sorts of other, you know, hardline social conservatism that's happening in the late 1980s that really leads to sort of the ugliness of the 1990s. And I think actually puts the Republican Party in the trajectory that we see today with the anti-trans stuff.
You also mentioned in talking about California, you know, the origination of gay people being threats to children in schools, like, I right. guess, being formalized within Republican circles. You can see that obviously today with the DeSantis politics.
Right, exactly. This groomer discourse. So that was very much part of the, you know, Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative. It was also coming out of Florida with Anita Bryant and her work in Miami-Dade County to overturn a gay rights ordinance there. This idea that, and Anita Bryant said this, and this became sort of the talking point of the nation or the talking point of the right, was that homosexuals couldn't reproduce, so they had to recruit. And who better to do that than public school teachers who spend all day with your, you know, your son and your daughter. And so I think all listeners can hear the resonance and the relevance of that old discourse to what's happening right now and the panics around schools and classrooms and elementary education, and all the ways in which DeSantis, I think, tapped into and revived those notions of a groomer panic. And now, of course, it's like in some ways a lot, it's like detached from homosexuality itself, but like, I think that is obviously the origin of it and remains sort of like, I think, the central nerve of that panic is this idea that particularly homosexual men and women are a threat and they're predators, right, to your children. And so, you know, this stuff doesn't go away. It just sort of gets refreshed and remade for new moments.
And I guess this is all around the time, too, where gay people really begin organizing for their rights, as of course they would, given the just, you know, absolute trauma of the HIV/AIDS pandemic right. and the lack of political will to help gay people as a protected group or LGBTQ plus people. And how did that begin to happen? Because like even in the 90s, Bill Clinton signing Don't Ask, Don't Tell into law, Biden, our current president, supportive of that as well. Like this is as you say, Democrats were not good on this. Like how did the organizing begin?
Not at all. And, you know, even like Sam Nunn, who's, you know, the ranking Democratic leader on the Senate, you know, the military committee, puts forward Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So Democrats are not doing well on this at all. And I think that, you know, again, the panic over HIV/AIDS as this public health threat shaped so much politics, and it was shaping politics both among Republicans and Democrats. But gay people were organizing nevertheless. And I think because of all this, because of the oppression and because of the real bigotry of this era, a lot of that organization is happening on the left. It's happening through gay Democratic organizations. It's also happening through these sort of mainstream gay organizations like the Human Rights Campaign and other organizations like that. But I think that you see a real recognition from gay people in this period of how bad they've got it, and also of how high the stakes are, particularly around a public health crisis. And also, they don't want to go back. to where things were just a couple of decades ago. And it really seems like that's a possibility, right? We're not that far away from people being living their lives completely in the closet. And I think in the 1990s, people really woke up and recognized. And so you have the March on Washington in 1993, where a million LGBTQ people come out. That is an incredibly significant moment and of showing, you know, visibility, of showing presence, of showing how large a population this is. And so for all the backlash, all the repression, and all the hate that's developing in this decade, I also think you see a huge commitment from LGBTQ people to not be silenced and to not be brought backwards.
And we are in another moment of reaction. So I guess we'll just take it to the present day as we wrap up here, Neil. The anti-trans backlash, the anti-groomer backlash from Republicans. I mean, some of these figures, like we had an IM write in saying, Laib Habibi says, Roy Cohn was a mentor to Trump at the center of of North, the red and lavender scares, and a homosexual himself. He's dead now, but, you know, this is not far in the past. And, you know, you mentioned Caitlyn Jenner, right, as a figure, almost as like a log cabin and the trans person, right? And we have guys like, I mean, who knows? We don't know for sure, but Lindsey Graham and other Republicans and other people who play this role to this day. So to bring it to the present, here, Neil, what is your view of this moment of reactionary sentiment?
Well, I think for, you know, all the progress that has been made, and it has been significant, I mean, and also in a short period of time, it's also, you know, as you say, important for us to remember that this hasn't been, that progress has not been around for very long. And so the potential for backlash and really regression here is enormous. And I think we see that in the current efforts around the anti-trans stuff. Gay Republicans argue, because they've supported a lot of the stuff of, like, you know, stuff Ron DeSantis has done and others have done, that Trump has done, that is, you know, anti-trans efforts. They've said, well, these are sort of limited, narrow pieces of legislation that are, you know, that make sense for the particular thing they're targeting. And the thing that I asked over and over again of the contemporary gay Republicans I interviewed was, are you not worried of where this is headed? And none of them are. And I think that that is very naive of them, because if anything, history shows us that these things are not disconnected. They're actually deeply woven together, and that the anti-LGBTQ movement has always been very coordinated, and it wasn't interested in just sort of, nitpicking an issue here, an issue or two here or there and reforming it, but actually of pushing history backwards. And so I think that that's the thing we all have to be mindful of and aware of where this is potentially headed.
Neil J. Young, the book is called Coming Out, A History of the Gay Right, or sorry, Coming Out Republican, apologies, A History of the Gay Right. Thank you so much for coming on today. We will put a link to your book in the description wherever people are listening to or watching this. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation.
Agreed. We are back, and we are joined now by Adrienne Marie Brown, activist, scholar, and New York Times bestselling author, whose latest book is entitled Loving Corrections. Adrienne, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Emma.
So we've talked a lot on this show about how people are really lacking in community these days. I mean, whether it be public space shrinking due to rampant privatization, whether it be like many parts of the country just being atomized geographically, or suburbia being this place where people have little fiefdoms and there's very little community involvement. You know, it increases a lot of, I feel like it exacerbates bigotry, it creates conspiracism and things like that. And it seems like that is such a central focus of your book, community through activism, through hearing one another. How conscious were you of maybe that kind of alienation that a lot of people seem to be experiencing in recent years?
I felt very conscious of it. I've been doing work in terms of trying to create more justice and more liberation in the world for almost 25 years. And one of the things I have witnessed over and over again is how people respond when they're given a chance to connect with each other and support each other, and how people respond when they're given instruction or push to divide from each other. And I see that divisiveness growing and growing. And I can really see how rapidly it's grown even in the last 5 years. And I saw it happening in every community, every space that I was in. And I'm an interracial kid. You know, I'm someone who operates with a lot of different communities that I feel like I'm a part of. And so for me, when I was seeing it, I was like, oh, this is a breaking down of places that I know can get along. Like, I know they can hear each other. I know they can understand each other. So I felt really mindful of how could I create a tool that people could use to have better conversations with each other.
I love that because when we hear about divisiveness in specifically in the context of politics, mm-hmm. it's usually about like, will you just stop calling us out for being racist? Stop being mm-hmm. so divisive. And, yeah. You know, your book has so many, it's like a guide for so many different kinds of people to build solidarity. Mm-hmm. But how do you draw a distinction between shunning opinions and people and far right movements in the way that mm-hmm. they should be shunned, and balancing that with creating solidarity with people who may not be there yet or may need some hand holding to get to a certain place?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're in a really interesting moment right now where like there are these big concepts, you know, MAGA, the far right, there's these huge concepts. And I think it can make us forget that we're actually in relationship, many of us, with people who are a part of whatever those huge concepts are. And as long as you're in a relationship, something else is possible still. So part of what I wanted to do was write a book that I was like, you can hand this to your racist uncle and then sit down and have a conversation about what comes up when you're talking about it. I've also been talking a lot. I was book touring this around the South, and a question came up around shame. Like, what about shame? Don't we need to like make people ashamed of some of these perspectives that they have? And the way I responded to it, which has been really sitting with me, is that we use shame to shrink things. And so we do want to shrink these concepts. You know, I want to shrink the concept of white supremacy or any supremacy. I want to shrink the concept of the earth being a disposable place. I want to shrink the concept that we can harm each other without any accountability. I want to not shrink the people. I want to shrink those ideas. I want to reclaim the people. I've almost been talking about it as people get caught in these prisons of ideas where they don't even understand that they're inside a limited space and that they're sometimes have born into it, growing up in it, growing up completely surrounded by people who are telling them hate is the only way you can belong. Looking down on others is the only way you can belong. You know, limiting other people's rights and freedoms is the only way you can belong or have power. Part of what we have to do is break each other out of those kind of ideas. And unfortunately, you know, I always say, I'm like, if this worked, maybe we would try it. Like if shame worked, maybe I would try it. But I'm like, I have not met people who get very ashamed about being white supremacist and that's the way it works. So then we have to try a different tactic. And I'm always like, how do we use our energy in the best possible way? For me, relationship is one of the best possible ways I know to actually make change. So it's reaching back out and saying, can we have a disagreement and stay connected? And can I still see your humanity when we're having this conversation? And if not, can I set a good boundary that still honors your humanity?
Is shame a very American concept? Like is the way, I mean,
I think that shame has been around forever,
yeah.
But I do think that there's a way that we deploy it. That is, you know, I think there's a way we do almost everything that is unique, which is, I think we have an idea of being better. Like we have an idea of ourselves as like the best nation in the world. And we have an idea of everything we're doing as being better than what anyone else is doing. And I think from that place, shame hits different, right? Because you're just like, oh, we're really trying to demoralize people. We're really trying to bring them down so that they will behave and they'll be part of the American experiment without trying to challenge it too much or change it too much, right?
We make fun of each other instead of
building each other up and building up the kind of values and you know, the values and the communities that we actually want.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, it's fine. It was something coming up for you, right?
Yeah, it just occurs to me that, you know, there's this very Protestant element of shame or to a degree, but it's, I think you're right in the sense of it shame is also atomizing in and of itself as opposed to communal. And I think that that's maybe why it doesn't have the efficacy that you describe.
Well, and, you know, I think that this is the same thing where people talk about cancel culture. I've written about this, but this idea of like, isn't that person ashamed of what they've done? And I think if we move that way, then often what happens is people isolate, they shift into a different community and they continue doing harmful things, or they keep doing the thing that was so shameful in the first place. And we shrink as movements who are trying to change, we shrink and shrink and shrink because we just keep losing people to this sort of shameful, they're moving away from us. I'm interested in a different move. And I'm not saying you have to go for the furthest away from you, you know, space politically. I'm not saying you have to call the most racist person you know, or the most, you know, whatever, deplorable, the person who's like most anti your existence, right? Because I do have people in my family who are homophobic, transphobic, all those things. I have all those things in my family. I'm not necessarily reaching all the way to them, but I might reach to my mom, who is still in relationship with people, and have a conversation with her that is like, how can I be really loving in my conversation with you? And then that you be really loving when you're in direct conversation with folks who are maybe too challenging for me to be in contact with right now. Like, that's a real thing. And then I do feel like I do want a future where people feel ashamed to be racist. I do want a future where people feel ashamed to be homophobic. But I think, again, it has to happen at a collective and mass level rather than trying to individually target people, because they can just shift out of accountability and go other places. I think that there's something so important about being able to sit down with someone and say, I think there's better. I think that you could be better. I think that our relationship could be better. And I think it would mean us seeing each other's humanity. And when you speak like this, when you talk like this, when you vote like this, I feel like you don't see my humanity and you don't care about my life. And I'm not giving up on you, you know? And right. I think that's a really different approach than just being like, oh, you said that? You know, don't, like, that's it. Now I'm leaving you to them, because the them is growing. that body of people, you know, I feel like 10 years ago, there's a lot of things that happen now in our political realm that that would be unimaginable even 10 years ago, because we've just been conceding the territory. Been like, oh yeah, you're just ridiculous. Go over there with the ridiculous people. And all of a sudden you have a huge, huge, massive voting block of people who are not connected to reality, not connected to science, not connected to community who holds them accountable. We can't afford that at this stage for the whole planet, for the whole species. We can't afford that.
And your first essay is directed towards men, right? You speak about how it's the first words are dear men, and you wanted to address seemingly patriarchy right off the bat. So much of what you're describing reminds me of other things we've discussed on the show about how incel online culture is growing, and for young men in particular. I know someone in my life who, when they were in a very lonely period of their life, was into Jordan Peterson. Then when in a relationship, more community, is just a progressive leftist, right? I mean, those things, that happens. But what's the incel stuff? They create these extremely rigid gender binaries. They talk about the value of women or as sexual objects in this extremely almost scientific way, where they try to naturalize it. They give these young men these ideas. They go out into the real world. Many women are turned off by the obvious rigidity of these gender roles. Then they get rejected and they go back for more. And that cycle to me is something I thought about when I saw what you were writing about, you know, telling men practice sitting in groups with other men was one of the planks, but also, you know, be vigilant about your masculinity not becoming toxic. Yeah. And that becomes so much harder when there's that isolation and then they go to these influencers on the internet.
Yeah, I think we have so many people now who have a podcast or have a platform, have a space to spew all kinds of stuff. And I think we're also in this really interesting moment in history that, you know, sometimes like when you're in something, you don't recognize what's happening. So I think when we were part of women's empowerment movement and women fighting for equality in the workplace and feminism movement, there's been all this movement, forward movement of women, forward movement of non-binary and trans people, forward movement. And instead of men feeling like, oh, wonderful, like, that's great, like, you know, all of humanity is coming into right relationship, there's this sense of, I'm losing my power, I'm losing my place, I don't know where I belong, I don't know how to be what I was trained to be. I was trained to be an alpha protector male, you know, I have an automatic importance in society. And now that's shifting, where it's like, you're not more important than anyone else in this society. And that can be a gift if you embrace it. But if you are being told you need to fight and you need to push these people back down, that's what all the abortion stuff is about. That's what all the reproductive justice, you know, struggles are about, is trying to push all the other genders back into their place so that men can maintain this dominance that they've been told they get to have. And what I was witnessing was seeing it really intimately, seeing it in relationships of women that I loved who were having children with men who then would slip into these regressive behaviors under pressure when they hit their midlife crisis mode, and just feeling so sad because I was like, I know, again, I know that's not your soul. I know that's not, you know, the spark of the miracle of life that is in you was not put on earth in order to terrify the women around you and to make us feel unsafe and to make us feel disempowered. So that letter for me was a love note to these men who I had at different points in my life looked at as brothers, looked at as beloveds, looked at as friends, and now was facing and seeing this violence, this pain coming through them. And I've actually had, since the essay first came out, that was one that was published on my blog before it was in the book. And I've had lots of people reach out to me because they've started groups of men who are sitting with each other and being like, how do we really reckon with having been raised inside of a system that we now want to eradicate from ourselves, that we want to heal from, and we want to find ways to access our whole humanity, which means being able to access the part of us that hurts and that is vulnerable and that wants to be a part of community and that wants to learn to be in love and be a good dad and you know, be a good family member. I think most humans want the same things, but the stories that we're told really impact what we can have access to in a lifetime. So part of what I'm trying to do here is tell some different stories.
Yeah, there's a dearth of positive masculinity in representation. And, you know, I think right now about the Trump campaign and what J.D. Vance represents in that area. And it's exactly yes. It's exactly what you're talking about. And the part about men and their, you know, you implore and say for men to be vigilant about their masculinity becoming toxic when they are in between their 30s and 50s. Yeah. You hinted at it there, but can you explain what you feel that phenomenon is tied to?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm really curious to see if this stays true over the next 50 years or so. But in this moment, we're in this transition phase, right? Where a lot of men were still born into a world where they were being trained to be these alpha male characters. And then there's been this huge shift in economics and power dynamics for men. And so now you have these men who are like, okay, like I'm down with that. And like kind of down with the idea of feminism, but wait, I didn't expect to feel so disempowered and unseated in my life. And so I'm 30 or 40 and I'm not the boss like that I thought I would be. Maybe I'm having to report to a woman. Maybe my wife is the person who's making more money than I am. How does my family look at me? Do they see me as a success if I'm a stay-at-home dad or if I'm sharing that load? I think that there's a real sense of identity loss of like, I don't quite know how to be this new kind of man or this other kind of man. And for me, a lot of the invitation is like, you don't have to be a different man. You just have to be a human, right? What we're inviting you towards is that there's a center place where it's like, this is what humanity actually is for all of us. That's what we want to invite you back into. You've been in a place where you think man puts you over here and women puts you down here, right? We're just saying, come back into humanity. We're all actually completely capable of doing all the things and most of the things we actually need to do together. You know, that's the other piece of this for me is I think men are reaching this age where a lot of what they've been told is that they're going to reach individual success, but we're actually in a massive shift where we need to do everything we're doing together in community. Like we're in a really precarious place. Our climate is a precarious place. We're on the brink of a lot of world war troubles. We're already involved in just so much struggle, so much pain, so much harm. We're in danger. Like, as a species, we're in danger. Men need to come and be a part of getting through this period, right? And we share the earth with them. I say this all the time, because I'll look at someone like J.D. Vance or Trump or whatever, and I'm like, I don't want to give that any of my life force, any of my attention. But then I'm like, I do share this earth with that person. I have to figure out how to contend with. They're trying to contend for power. I have to be able to contend for power as well. And I have to be able to deal with the fact that they exist and something in them is so wounded and needs so much healing. And I might not be able to heal that person in my lifetime, but I can create more space for masculinity that is part of humanity.
Very well said. And I love that essay in your book. Again, people should mm-hmm. read this and give it to men in your life that you think yes. may be open to it, or maybe if they aren't. Mm-hmm. And there were another part that resonated with me was the fighting racism, where you direct advice to white people in particular, learning to own the impact of white supremacy, doing anti-racist work without it being self-serving. These are some of the advice that you give. But yeah. I was really the specific section that you carve out for Jewish Americans. It was really fascinating, embracing anti-Zionism in the same way that more progressive white people have embraced anti-racism. This yeah. is so necessary in this moment for obvious reasons amidst the genocide in Gaza. Can you yeah. talk about that section, and then in particular your choice to include that kind of extra piece?
Yeah, it was an addendum. You know, it was something I wanted to bring in. And I think it came from, you know, a real sense of like, these really harmful ideas can get bonded with our identity such that we think that that's who we are. And so, you know, that's part of why we talk about racism and we talk about white supremacy, particularly that there's this idea of supremacy that got bonded in with what it meant to be a white person. When the whole idea of whiteness was being formed, it was being woven in, right? That supremacy is a part of it. And so now when people are like, oh, I'm an anti-racist, like I'm a white person, but I'm actively working against that connection that happened. I think the same thing happened for Jewish people with Zionism. There's been Judaism forever. There's been Jewish people since the beginning. And they've been practicing in so many different ways, so many communal ways, so many beautiful ways. I have a lot of incredible Jewish friends in my life who have gifted me the practice of ritual with them, of Shabbat with them. I've gotten to go through some of these things. I'm like, oh, what it means to be Jewish is actually to be loving, to be caring, to be looking out for your neighbors, to be thinking about repair from harm. Zionism comes in and is like, this is about taking land and claiming something and trying to create an ethnostate. That's a totally different project from what Judaism has been about for its entire existence. But it comes in at this interesting moment where there's a ton of trauma, and you can take advantage of that and you can fuse these things together. So I wanted to talk about that because I learned that from anti-Zionist Jewish people, that they were like, the way that I began to understand that Zionism wasn't a fundamental aspect of being Jewish. It was actually a really harmful thing that was happening. And we were raised to think it was a beautiful vision and that it was our destiny. But actually it's causing so much harm. It's causing so much dissonance in our community. And now we see this genocide playing out, where I think if any other country was doing what Israel is doing right now, we would be very clear-headed. And it's even interesting, you know, to watch the debate and to be like, oh, look at this, the differences in the stance on Ukraine and the stance on Palestine, where the power dynamics are so similar. And we're showing up in one situation for the person who's being attacked and in one situation for the person who is doing the attacking. And yes, there's so much, I mean, we can unpack and unpack and unthread and unthread. But for me, as a Black person who has really lived in this country and watched and become in deep community with white people undoing racism, it felt so important to me to see that there was an option like this for Jewish people that was like, oh, we can undo this work as well. And in this moment, I think one of the most beautiful things I've seen amidst all the horror is how many Jewish people are like, oh, I can let go of Zionism and I can heal, I can recover my soul, and I can recover community. And in doing that, that's the way that we will actually stop this problem, not just in this moment, but in an ongoing way. Because I think that's also the piece, is now people are not just saying we want a ceasefire. It's like, we want an arms embargo and we want to stop this occupation. We want to end this. And I will also say this, I live on land that was stolen. I live in the United States. And so it's very personal for me. I'm like, I wasn't there at the moment in history when I could have intervened on this happening and could have changed the story of this happening. But I'm here now, and my country is supporting the same thing happening somewhere else, and I can intervene. I can play a role in that. So it felt really important for me to include that.
Yeah. And I think the optimism about that moment, that display of solidarity for a free Palestine in this current moment is, I think, you know, part of the vision that you're hoping for, which is a glimmer of hope in this. And can you expand a little more on the notions of power and whiteness and how you including that section, you know, it's also an acknowledgement that whiteness and power through whiteness is done through imperialism too, and that Zionism has folded into that, obviously, but that history is so present, I think, in white supremacy all around us.
Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, I want to acknowledge, you know, and as I was writing it, I was like, I understand that Jewish people are a multiracial people. And then I also understand, and what I see, the visual of what's happening between Israel and Palestine is very much that Israel has, in part of its development, really drawn in white Jewishness and really created a space of whiteness for Jewish people. And if you study American history, you see how whiteness developed and how it has claimed one people at a time, right? It's like, okay, we're starting off with these French people. Okay, now, all right, Italians, okay, Irish people, like, y'all can be down. Now Jewish people come in a different way, where they're like, we were oppressed by white people. We were oppressed by people who wanted to be Aryan. So the journey from going from that to being in a space where you're like, mostly in the US, when we were moving through the world, we're identified as white people. We're seen as white people. And it gives us a different kind of access and a different kind of power than brown people have. And when I speak with anti-Zionist Jewish people, they're like, I can see that. I can understand that. I can acknowledge that. And then I can take responsibility for it. I think that's part of what we're seeing play out internationally now, is that we're looking at the Middle East and we're partnering with people who have the whitest looking leadership, people who would come to this country and be acknowledged as white people. We're being like, that's where we're going to pour our energy and attention. That's who we're going to call our ally. That's who we're going to call our friend, the people who will serve Western interest in this part of the world. It's deep. And the other piece of this, I think, that we have to bring in is we're in a, you know, it was 9/11 yesterday. It was like, we're in a long arc in the US with our Islamophobia, with our anti-Arab sentiment, with our racism against people from that part of the world. So these things are all tied in, right? And one of the things I keep trying to do is like pull them apart just enough so we can look at them clearly and be like, oh, we were told to see these people as untrustworthy, as terrorist, as violent. We were told that as a Black person. I'm like, I've been on the other end of that same kind of storytelling where all of my people are something and all of us deserve some kind of punishment, and all the white people are innocent and all of them are victims and all of them deserve protection. And once you start to see it, you can't unsee it, right?
They deploy the same tropes. Yep.
Yeah, and it's sexual violence, but it's also like the story only gets told one way, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was so interesting in the debate when Kamala was like, well, look at where all this started, October 7th. And I was like, oh, that's such, that's a very Western way to tell that story, right? Yep. To say, oh, you know, and it, again, because it's the same thing that happened with 9/11, where it's like, oh, this just happened to us out of the blue, out of nowhere. We have no idea why it happened. Instead of saying, what are the conditions that are being created around the world that would make people want to do this, right? Can we get curious about it? And without having to justify it, right? I think that there's a distinction that's important, that's being able to say, I'm not in charge of whatever strategies people are using for their resistance, but can I understand why people might engage in resistance, or why people might engage in pushing back against empire, or why people might engage in pushing back against those who are oppressing them? And one of the things I think we are privileged in is that we get to sit in a place where I'm like, well, I'm not under bombs and constant attack and being enclosed in a small space. I have room to have a ton of nuance about everything that's happening. Yep. But when I have been in situations of deep oppression, that nuance fell away. All I was concerned with was, how do I get this person to stop hurting me? And whatever story I need to change to get them to stop hurting me, I'm going to try to do that. I think we're in that situation right now where there's a ton of people who are like, how do I get this person to stop hurting me? And to be a U.S. citizen is to recognize, like, we are the funder of most of the harm that's happening in the world. We are thinking it through. We are collaborating with those who are causing harm. And we need to take responsibility for that if we hope to continue to exist.
Yeah. Exactly. And, yeah. What, you know, we're limited on time. I could go on about that for quite a while, but yeah. There's so much in your, you know, you spoke about the earth a little bit. You have a chapter about being accountable to the earth,
yes.
that I'd love for you to touch on, but, personally, you had your section on your conversation with your sisters was something yes. that I really loved. Like, yeah. I have a sister, and I really resonated with yeah. how you talked about how you guys would argue and lacking models of conflict resolution when growing up. Yep. Like, my parents are lawyers, so we were taught to argue a lot.
Yeah, let's litigate this.
I'm in this job, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit. Yeah. But not yeah. the conflict resolution part, and we've gotten right. better. But, like, some of your suggestions about these kind of interfamilial dynamics are really key here too, because we always get IMs from viewers about my brother's in the QAnon rabbit hole, my dad yeah. is a Trump supporting the whatever, and how mm-hmm. do I approach them about this? I think this the conversation that you transcribe between you and your sisters is about repair in those relationships, if you could
That's
talk
right.
a bit about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do appreciate it's all connected to me, right? That I'm like, even when I look at Israel Palestine, I'm like, y'all are all brothers and sisters. We're all brothers and sisters. Like, in all these places where conflict is happening, we're actually all family. We're all related. We're all coming from the same root systems. All of us are, but none of us learn conflict resolution. Almost none of us learn it at a young age. And that plays out at the small scale, at the, you know, local scale, at the federal scale, and at the international scale. Like, I think it's the same thing happening in at every level. So for me, I'm like, okay, let's bring it back down to the most accessible place for many of us, which is every year I'm going to see my family at least once. How do I shape those conversations? And this idea of repair, of being proactive about it, is recognizing most of the time the conflicts that are happening, it looks like it's about something that's happening between us, but so often it's actually about stuff that's happening within our own lives. And things that are not being seen, right? Those, that cousin who's like slipping off into a cult, something was not being seen usually in that person. There was a way that person was not being heard. They were moving into a crisis of isolation, of individualism, of not feeling honored, of not feeling smart enough, of not being recognized in dating or whatever it is. Something's happening where that person's being lost in the social fabric. They're slipping through. And as siblings, as loved ones, as family, we're in a unique position to be like, hey, I see you. I see that something's going on. Can we talk about it? Can you tell me what's happening? When we started doing these check-ins, like, we have political differences. They're not that kind of, you know, it's not like that kind of
a gulf, right?
Yeah. It's not like a huge chasm. I'm like, hey, girl, you know, but we were coming together and being like, we're exploding over how the dishwasher got loaded or something. And then having to cry it all out and be like, well, what was really happening is I'm super stressed at my job, or my money's not right, or I just went through a breakup, or something's happening with my health, or I'm in a grieving process. And I need you to know that so that you can be tender with me. That's the thing that almost everyone wants, is people to look at them and be like, I can be tender with you. I can still see the child in you. I can see the person that I love in you. And I can give you room for your humanity and your contradictions and your need for repair, whatever that might be. I can learn to give you a good apology. And then I can learn, you know, the best apology is the one where it includes how you're not going to do something again and you don't do it.
Right.
So it's like really learning to make those adaptations as well. I think that if more people were able to practice this at the intimate level, and I also want to say, like, if your family doesn't feel like the safe space to practice this, chosen family or other, your friendship circles, there's tons of places where you can actually practice this. The idea is to just be very intentional. Like, we're going to be together how are we? Let's start off with how are we actually coming into this? And then let's be.
Yeah. Very, very, very well said and beautiful message, honestly. I really hope people take the lessons from this. And there's so many more essays in here that we didn't have time to get to, but that's why you should be buying the book. That's the point of this. So the book is called Loving Corrections. We'll put a link to that in the description wherever people are listening to or watching this. Adrian, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me and the work y'all do. Appreciate it.
Hey folks, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and check out our daily show. We do it every day at 12 p.m. Eastern for about 2.5 hours. We even take phone calls. You should check that out. My fellow CEO, Mike Lindell, apparently went to the DNC, but had to disguise himself first. Mm-hmm. And so he decided to shave his mustache. Can we put up, do we have a picture first of like, of Matt Walsh? Can you find a picture of Matt Walsh as apparently disguised himself so he can walk amongst the DNC? It's a real clever disguise.
We have a live footage of it from up above. Here's Matt Walsh in a hat. He's dressed in Kamala gear.
All kinds of people, and she was effective in getting
this is zooming in. You can see him there.
Oh, that's him with the red hat. Yeah, there he is.
They're going to cut back. There he is. Oh, how funny. Oh.
Is his hair really that long for a ponytail? Wow.
No, he's wearing
He's got a wig on. He's a wig.
Ponytail wig.
Okay. He's been photographed in this wig before. Republicans, men, Crowder, I include in this, love dressing up in long, luscious wigs.
Well, you know what's sort of like, I think, bizarre about this? I mean, I went and crashed the RNC in 2004, but I just dressed like I was dressing at the time, which was, you know, a bow tie and a sport jacket. I didn't have a wig or, you know, get a special hairdo. But
the bow tie was just how you were dressing at the time, or was that a Tucker Carlson dig?
Well, it was a joke that I was trying to confuse people, but it wasn't just for the RNC. RNC took place in like August. I had been doing this since April to confuse people when I did cable TV hits. So they could say, because I sort of looked like Tucker at the time. We were both a little bit, you know, plumper. And I wanted people to go like, what happened with that guy with, he had glasses too, I think, at that time. What happened with that guy with the bow tie? Because that was the only way that people remembered him. He was the bow tie guy. Mm-hmm. And I figured I could confuse people. So it wasn't really to like be incognito at the convention. But they really love to cosplay. Here's Mike Lindell taking us behind the veil to watch him shave his mustache. This is, for a lot of people, I should say, I want to say trigger warning, but really it's more like not safe for work. If you're at work and you might get titillated by this, I would be careful.
Oh, he's back. Oh, there we go. Oh. Yeah. Yep.
You're back. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Now we got to get the rest of the skies on. Okay. Let me see how it looks all in one thing. Here we go. This would be, I'll use this, the police gave me this as the last, if things get out of hand. And we'll be on me.
You're not doing
listen
to him
snicker.
Yeah.
There's snicker.
Just real quick, Bradley. If you're in a room with a guy like this, you're not doing him any favors laughing at every one of his weird jokes like that. At a certain point, you got to be like, you're kind of acting strange, buddy.
All right. Well, if they're working for him, they're not in their right state of mind. So I don't know what to tell you. It's hard to give them advice.
The premise for this, too, is that like everybody's going to know that Mike Lindell is trying to crash the Democratic convention, and they're all like, they've got like all sorts of like, who's on the keep Mike Lindell from like cracking the case squad?
Yeah, oh, great well, prank pharma. Yeah,
just be careful. This is like, you know, like Mission Impossible stuff. Go ahead.
We got this at a local hat place here in Chicago,
Panama Jack.
This is really about somebody who wants to be able to dress up.
You can't tell it's the guy whose name you probably wouldn't remember anyway.
On his way.
What do you guys think?
To a Havana casino in
the 1900s. Hide the cross, Mike. They're going to know you right away.
Pause it. Wait a second. I just want to make this also clear. Pause it for 1 second.
Jesus.
Oh, Jesus. It is. They are trying to disguise a lunatic crazy guy as a lunatic crazy guy. Just a different one.
Is that one of those guys accused of shooting JFK?
This is the funniest prank I've ever seen.
They'll
I'm
never
dress
know.
Slightly different.
I'm like DB Cooper.
They'll never know that I'm insane if I dress like this.
I have like three guys with camera phones following me.
Looking good. I knew you would, baby.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, this is how you spice it up,
it's
folks.
It's worth it, you guys. I mean, we've got to...
Hey, do you recognize me?
We're going to the DNC. We're going to get going there like this. We're going to interview. We're going to get people...
Wait, can you pause it for a second?
Yeah, pause real quick.
Okay, so he has a tan line on his upper lip. Of course. Right?
Hey, that happens. Look,
well, that
okay.
happens
somebody who just got rid of a stash.
But with all that said, like, what does he think he's going to get looking like that, as opposed to going in there as Mike Lindell? Like, people go, oh, you're just a normal guy wearing sunglasses inside and a hat. And of course, I'll talk to you, but I would never talk to Mike Lindell.
Going there like this, we're going to interview, we're going to get people. I want to go find the media. I want to get to the media. So when the media is there at the DNC, then we're going to tell them about the event tomorrow here in Chicago, which is absolutely going to be the biggest event in this week.
A massage
chair. One of the most important events of the year, because we're going to bring Democrats from all over Chicago that voted for Biden. And now they're voting for Donald Trump. And we're going to ask them, oh, why are you doing that? What did you switch?
Thank you. Okay.
Wow, that's so deep.
We have to get to when he got into the convention center. Sam, have you seen this video of him having an interaction?
No.
I'm not even going to tell you what happens. He came in very hot, and you get to watch this and see it fresh.
That's in your state. You want to know more in your state? So they just found 250.
Pause it real quick. Pause it. For folks just listening, he is debating what looks like a 12-year-old child.
12-year-old boy.
This is a Democratic surrogate, I think, for Kamala. His name is Noah. It's K-N-O-W-A. He's like a little boy influencer.
Yes. A little boy influencer.
He's a literal child. Like, he's a literal. He is probably 10 years old.
This is at one point, like when we were doing the Ken and Ken parody, we did a Crowder parody where, like, I debated my then 5-year-old son, and this is literally what it looks like.
Mike approaches him,
and Lindell makes a beeline for him, like finds him. Like,
there's a kid. There's a kid. Let's go.
He's not gonna recognize me.
State. You want to know more in your state?
So
they just found 257,000 votes. This happened last week. A judge ruled in Georgia that are missing from the 2020 election. Yeah.
So
this just came out. You're behind. You
so
should.
So your source is Trust Me, Bro? That's your source?
No, the source. It's in your papers in Georgia. You need to read
you
your news.
You haven't given me any
you
last
need
name.
To read your news. No, this is your Georgia news. This is your Georgia.
Thanks, buddy. Have a good day, sir.
His disguise worked perfectly.
No.
That kid had no idea that he just got bammied by Mike Lindell. You just got pillowed, buddy.
No, Noah, the 12-year-old boy, walks away from Lindell saying, "You're a clown, bro." he literally is like, "You're full of crap," he says. This 12-year-old boy.
You call me a clown, but you don't even realize I'm Mike Lindell.
He had no idea who he was talking to. He thought he was talking to some idiot.
It's me, Mike Lindell. I shaved my mustache. You idiot.
Like, who? toes, Michael?
Oh my God.
I know. He goes up to the boy. That's the part that I just can't get over.
Oh my God. Is there any more, Mike Lindell? Please, please. I don't know. Can we intersperse it with...
We'll monitor the feed.
Hey, folks, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and check out our daily show. We do it every day at 12 p.m. Eastern for about 2.5 hours. We even take phone calls. You should check that out.